Good morning, and welcome to GSV's virtual summit. Following up on our success in April, we decided to extend this in for a few sessions here in May. I'm Deborah Quazzo, the managing partner of GSV Ventures and the co-founder of the ASU GSV Summit, and we're thrilled to have everyone here today. It's my incredible pleasure. There he is coming live. I could put my Jacksonville background in the background of my Zoom, Alberto. I've got that in my repertoire somewhere here. My picture actually is from Jacksonville, though, I will note. We are incredibly honored to have Alberto Carvalho here with us this morning to be able to do a fireside chat. Alberto is a pretty remarkable figure, and I actually thought I'd start with his personal story in a time when I think could use some inspiration, and hearing kind of how he got to where he got to, I think helps that. Alberto grew up in Portugal. He was the son of hardworking parents of modest means. As I understand, you were only one of your six siblings to graduate from high school. You came to the United States undocumented, worked your way up in this country through hourly jobs, obviously experienced homelessness along the way, obviously became a citizen, got to college, and ultimately you became a physics, chemistry, and calculus teacher in Miami. You then had a series of promotions, assistant, associate or assistant superintendent, and then in 2008, you were appointed superintendent of Miami-Dade. And aside from New York trying to steal you once, you have had a notably long and important tenure there. It is the fourth largest district in the country. It is 91% students of color, 350,000 roughly total students, 73% of which are on free and reduced lunch. Alberto has won things like Superintendent of the Year, leadership around technology, and he and his leadership team, his broad leadership team of teachers and administrators, have really engineered a whole district turnaround. So I thought, with the backdrop, Alberto, of your life story, I actually just wade into my first question, was really around empathy, because given where you came from, you were able to bring to bear empathy for your students, your teachers, and your administrative leadership, your teacher leadership, your administrative leadership. It's actually National Mental Health Month, as you well know. I actually read a blog that your associate superintendent posted a couple days ago. COVID has obviously exacerbated anxieties and mental health issues of all forms, especially for our most vulnerable students. Miami-Dade has been a leader in implementing district-wide mental health programs, including leveraging technology like AR and VR to address these issues. And I'd love to have you, if you wouldn't mind, speak to this and how you and your leadership team and school leaders have been addressing the mental health needs of students and for that matter, of everyone in the district during this COVID crisis.
Well, good morning, everyone, particularly to you, Deborah. It's great to see you once again, and to the GSV community. Our warm greetings to all of you from sunny Miami. As you correctly said, we began paying close attention, being very deliberate in terms of augmenting our presence in the social, emotional, and mental health and well-being space, not only for our students, but for their parents as well as our workforce, well before Parkland, but certainly after Parkland, with state revenues being appropriated, we dramatically ramped up our presence in that space, creating the first mental health department in the entire state of Florida, with over 60 mental health professionals, developing new protocols through the early identification of issues, crisis, anxiety, fear, bullying, what have you, in schools, the ability to connect. And this, by the way, is over and above the school psychologists, the social workers, and the counselors. A trust counselor is included, but then being able to connect those children, their families, to third-party providers outside of the school system for there to be a continuum of services that expands beyond the schoolhouse. Certainly, with the advent of COVID-19 and this crisis, we recognized yet again that there were new pressures both on students, parents, and staff. Therefore, we pivoted significantly to bring these resources now, utilizing the assets, the platforms we have, whether we're talking about virtual support, the possibility for chat rooms, for peer-to-peer mentoring to deal with stress and anxiety, the development of very successful hotlines that parents, children, and employees can call in and real-time be connected with a professional who can specifically deal with the issue, but then also refer them to a long-term provider. So I believe we pivoted twice during just a couple of years in terms of augmenting the provision of social and emotional support. It is something we teach in our schools, right alongside mindfulness, right alongside curriculum programs recommended to us by the American Psychiatric Association and many others, empowering particularly the youth with being active members in a school community and the recognition of stress, anxiety, troubled behavior on the part of other students, and then being able to report it safely, sometimes confidentially, but then also being a voice as a peer support member to the student community.
That's fantastic. So would you anticipate that you would leave your initiatives there at that scale post-COVID?
You know, that's a fantastic question. I anticipate, actually I predict, not only for Miami-Dade, but for the entire country, that post-COVID-19, a lot of the platforms, systems that have been created, the shift from traditional teaching and learning, and along that goes psychological, mental, social, and emotional support, now to a virtual environment where these services can be accessed 24/7, anytime, anywhere. I predict that they will continue, not only here in Miami-Dade, but across the country. Look, we opened a powerful curtain that demonstrated that teaching and learning does not necessarily have to be confined to bricks and mortar environments. And one powerful participant in this process has been the parent, who for weeks now is home with a child and has a front row seat to what's happening in terms of the education children are getting. Parents are not going to let go of that sense of empowerment and day-to-day monitoring of events. So yes, everything will shift. And one of the shifts will be the continuance of the availability of these services, indispensable, essential services, not only in a traditional way when conditions allow, but also in novel virtual ways that we were forced to migrate to. That was not the case in Miami. We already had many choice programs that utilized 21st century technology, but as a nation, we were forced to migrate there. To think that now, when the crisis is lifted, we're going to go back to the old normal is, quite frankly, not a realistic scenario. There will be a new normal that takes full advantage of everything that has been enabled since the start of this crisis. And that, by the way, is a good thing.
I really hope you're right, because that, yeah, as we think about it, this our framing BC to AD, which is before corona to after disease, and I love your vision, and I hope you're dead right, because I think the what has happened has been transformative in many ways, not always successful, but transformative in many, many positive ways. So that actually, you give me the perfect segue. So the inspiration for, you know, my reach out actually came from an interview I did with Jeb Bush a couple of weeks ago on our series, and where he really cited the seamless move from physical to digital or remote learning in Miami-Dade. And, you know, I'd love you to, you know, you just obviously you just sort of brushed over it, but love you to talk about it. I mean, how was it that you all, what had you done in terms of preparedness? You know, how much hardware was distributed? How did you deal with Wi-Fi access? Obviously, that's been a big issue all over the country. And then kind of any other thoughts you might have for now, you know, district and school leaders around the country. And just a particular adjunct to that, you guys have gotten 92% attendance, as I understand it, and that also appears to be a large issue for some. So love to hear you talk about that too, Ed, you know.
Sure. So let me begin by saying we currently have 100% connectivity. That means student connectivity, 92 to 93% daily student attendance. We distributed in excess of 119,000 personal devices.
And is that attendance actually higher than what you would get in a physical setting? Comparable?
It's comparable about 1% off a traditional school day attendance, which is quite remarkable.
Yep, quite remarkable.
11,000 hotspots, a partnership with Comcast. We were the first district to ask Comcast Xfinity to deploy resources to address the digital deserts that exist in certain zip codes. And in addition to that, I have to tell you, we began the planning to be where we are today, not to respond to COVID-19, but to be where we are today because we anticipated that at some point in the future, this day would come. And we began this journey back in 2012 when we passed a massive $1.2 billion bond referendum, $250 million of which was earmarked for technology, to expand bandwidth, to create universal, ubiquitous Wi-Fi in all of our schools with a signal strength that extended beyond the school walls, to make decisions regarding grade level and standards aligned digital content that we have curated through purchase, but also developed here in Miami-Dade, making decisions regarding platforms, establishing training on Microsoft Teams and Zoom with great partnerships with Microsoft. So we began making those investments. And of course, I don't believe in buying personal devices through bond money. You are in essence, taking a mortgage out for 30 years for a device whose life cycle is 3 years. But we use different finance mechanisms to then acquire through a lease purchase model, hundreds of thousands of devices. So here's what happened in January. We did not wait for the federal government or state government to tell us that COVID-19 could be a disruptive force in Miami. I placed COVID-19 coronavirus on my leadership meeting agenda in January. And we put on the board worst case scenario. You shut down 520 schools because this is not a matter of if, but when will it impact us and to what extent? So let's start with the worst case scenario. Shut down 520 schools, have 355,000 pre-K-12 kids at home, in addition to 150,000 adult and technical learners that receive services through us, in addition to 48,000 employees. At a time when the economy comes to a standstill, what do we do? Well, we were lucky because we began our planning for the shutdown in January. By the time February rolled around, we were already having, and certainly into March, conversations even with unions about the protocols for accountability during virtual teaching. So when we switched off traditional teaching and activated distance learning, we had protocols in place. The teachers and the students had an ease of transitioning to this environment because the assets they were using at home, the only thing that changed was geography. The assets they were using at home were the assets that they were using in the classroom. The applications were the same. Now they were just doing it from a different geography. With that said, intensive professional development to guarantee smooth transition, 100% attendance by teachers on that professional development, activation of support lines, telephonic lines, email lines, for student support, teacher support, technical support, and the development, and this I think is one of the coolest things, a virtual parent academy to empower parents with a skill set to help students navigate this schooling at home, which is different than homeschooling. That is why, not devoid of challenges or problems, but that is why we are where we are, I think ahead of the curve, not having faltered in many ways, unfortunately, like many other examples that we've seen across the country. So it was preparation that goes back to 2012, intensified by current conditions. We're now at a point where we're examining contingency plans for the return that look at 10 to 12 different options. And that too is not a bad thing. We want to empower, we want to see and recognize an opportunity in the middle of this crisis. And that for me is now leveraging the knowledge we have, the access and the equity that we have built to meet students where they are and teach them 24/7, anytime, anywhere.
So I want to string a little along. I love this parent empowerment theme, so important. Because to me, I think what's fascinating is we're calling it remote learning. The reality is, high income districts have students learning at home all the time, right? They've got devices, they've got, you know, software, they've got whatever that they can afford, and students spend more time at home than they do actually in the literal school building. So to me, this is, it's remote, but you're remote. So my hope is that one of the practices that comes to play in back to parent empowerment is that for low income families or middle income families that were not typically using the home as a place of learning on a continuous basis, whether it was lack of Wi-Fi or lack of devices or lack of parental instruction of guidance on how to do it, that post COVID in the AD world, that we begin to see a lot more at home activity for students who hadn't had that muscle built previously. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense to me. Look, let's recognize one thing. Access is the enabler of equity, and equity ultimately in the educational environment is the precursor to equal opportunity as far as high quality learning. So if you do not have access, and I'm talking about both parent and student, because it's not lost to us, the day the child has that device at home with full connectivity, we send it home with a parent portal and a student portal. So we now have a two-way gateway of access, communication, feedback, influence to parents as well as students. So I think we are empowering parents. I've always talked about this dynamic of school systems and parents following the law of economics, supply and demand. You're absolutely right. You described very well the demand-side of parenting. They have everything. They have the time, the resources, the connectivity, right? The content, the experience. But we have a lot of supply-side of parents. They supply children with very few questions asked. I want to turn those supply-side of parents into demand-side of parents because now they have the tools. I want them to push us as much as possible. But you're absolutely right. This is a new reality that we're not going to back away from as conditions improve, because I think we now have a direct pipeline of information, feedback, influence to every single child's home. So we are addressing both the needs of children, but also listening carefully, helping parents, but also accepting their feedback. Just understand the possibility of the parental data analytics that we may be able to obtain in the process of trying to help kids. This is powerful. And I think amidst this crisis, again, it's an opportunity that has emerged, an opportunity that just doesn't pop to the surface. You go and find it. And we've been deliberate in terms of finding these opportunities amidst the crisis.
Okay, so we have likely a lot of ed tech entrepreneurs in the audience, and so I'd like to maybe take advantage of this moment to actually let you potentially gin up an idea for someone to take the ball and run with. You've been a tech savvy superintendent from the very beginning. Clearly, the way you have it's not the you've not viewed ed tech as a silver bullet, but you've seen it as a way to drive equity and access. That there's no better poster child situation for it than where we are right now. You started iPrep Academy, which is a very, non-traditional school, and I'll come back to that if we have some time. You were named, Tech Savvy, 10 Top Tech Savvy Superintendents of the Year, and you've been very active in this area. If you stood back right now and thought about pain points within the district, which would include the, parent at home and in schools, what area would you suggest for entrepreneurs that could and should be addressed by smart, energetic founders who might be able to think of a great solution to a great district pain point?
So I would ask, love the question. I would ask for help on two levels. One may seem non-traditional. I'll start with that one. Help me with advocacy at state level and federal level to finally decouple. Number one, dramatically change FCC rules that dictate upon E-rate how funds to support technology can be used in districts. Liberalize it. Allow innovation, because right now the FCC rules that dictate over E-rate, which helps a lot of districts utilize technology money, are very restrictive, archaic, decadent. Secondly, help me decouple public education funding from mandated seat time. It's insane. Come on, we're experiencing this now under this crisis. we need to be able to have public education delivered in the way that meets children where they are in terms of their proficiency, their performance, their socioeconomic status, their geography, where they reside in school or out of school through blended and hybrid models. Now, specific to the tech world, look, I'm looking for collaboration. I'm looking for a joint venture where true personalized, adaptive, paying close attention to special needs students and English language learners, personalized, adaptive platforms and content are delivered on the basis of the data that we possess, and we are a data-rich district. You know, data is our DNA, it's our super strength, utilizing our data, building a system that recognizing that a lot of parents may opt for a blended learning environment, a hybrid model, or altogether outside of the school for a prolonged period of time. Personalized adaptive models utilizing our data that exactly prescribe for the child not only the best modality of learning, but the pace, the guide, and the excitement that motivates them periodically with the necessary feedback of data performance to us, not relying on monthly or quarterly assessments, but organic assessment that the student doesn't even perceive is assessment, but generates data.
We call it invisible assessment.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Okay, I could talk to you for 2 hours. Unfortunately, we're a little bit over our time. Thank you so much for your leadership and your service. I am very hopeful that there will be national collaborations around creating plans like the ones that you have built in Miami-Dade. And we so appreciate your time today. Thank you so much, Alberto.
Deborah, thank you so much, and best of luck, and let's see through this. There will be an end in sight. Just at the end of this cycle, let's be better for it if we're smart enough. Thank you.
Bravo. Agreed. Thank you. And with that, I'm going to hand this over to my partner, Julia Stieglitz, who will introduce the next panel.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I'd like to welcome our panelists for this discussion on the future of learning in higher education. We have Andrew Grauer, the co-founder and CEO of Course Hero, Judy Olian, the president of Quinnipiac University, Chip Pauset, the co-founder and CEO of 2U, and Mike Siligadzi, the founder and CEO of Top Hat. Welcome, everyone.
Hey, Julia.
Thanks, Julia.
Thanks for being here.
Hi.
So to get started, this spring we have experienced really emergency online teaching, where millions of teachers and learners were thrown into an online environment literally overnight. And the results have been mixed. There's, you know, at best, one study which showed that, one survey which showed that about 75% of students are saying that they're not having a quality learning experience. As we look towards the fall and then beyond, how do we move past this and how do we start really embracing what online has to offer? And I'm gonna start with Chip.
Okay, Julia. So, well, I guess I would say it hasn't been a high quality experience. I don't think it's possible that you could do high quality online education overnight the way that was required. I mean, on one hand, I give the schools incredible credit for being able to deploy anything that quickly, because it's pretty remarkable how, you know, this is completely unprecedented what happened. You know, obviously, like, how prepared could the NBA be for not playing any of its games? You know, you're talking about something society's never seen before. At the same time, like, what happened in the spring won't cut it on a go-forward basis. You've got to deliver something that is sort of purpose-built for high-quality online education. And, you know, I feel like we've got a long track record of doing that in our particular case. But when you think about the institutional imperative, you really do have to provide sort of clarity of driving towards something that is high-quality online and not just sort of forced remote learning. And I would say it's difficult. You know, it's expensive to do it well. And I think you have to get alignment among all parties involved, which is really tough. You know, universities are complicated operating environments, to say the least. You know, you've got a combination of faculty governance and a wide variety of different types of disciplines. So what I do like seeing right now is you've got across our 73 partners, people are looking for something better and trying to drive to something better for the fall, regardless of whether or not it's you know, an insurance policy or something that is meant to drive longer term quality. So you know, I'm optimistic on what can be done, and we're seeing our partners do some pretty incredible things. I don't know if you saw, we had a pretty big announcement with Simmons University out of Boston just this past week to really take the entire institution online with 2U. But I'd be curious what the other panelists would say.
Great, thanks, Chip. Judy, what are your thoughts as a leader of one of these complicated operating environments?
Well, thanks, Julia. You know, I go back to the fact that teachers teach. It's not technology that teaches. And this is bringing us back to the fundamentals of pedagogy. And it is a new experience for many of our faculty to transition, though Quinnipiac has been in the online world for quite a while, so we had quite a leg up. But it is an opportunity to really go back to the fundamentals of pedagogy. And when we've surveyed our students, and we just had a survey of by the Student Government Association of many hundreds of our students, the biggest complaint wasn't the quality of teaching or the quality of learning. It was really the balancing of an analysis of their workload, also about grading, about how grading was done, rather than the concern about how faculty are teaching and adjusting, because it is an intimate learning environment. You do have to draw on basics of pedagogy about how you draw people in, how you engage them, peer-to-peer opportunities, because so much learning occurs through that. But it requires our students to draw on some skills that they haven't necessarily had to draw on, which is spending more time teaching myself, some self-discipline, self-motivation, strong communication, adapting, being flexible, accountability for results. Those are actually skills that are needed in the workplace. So it's not a foreign exercise for our students to have to go through this process. What I think it has done has been to force ourselves to remember to engage in the science of pedagogy. How do you really learn? And to take our faculty back into that exercise, which I think has been a very positive exercise. But it isn't about the technology per se. It's about teachers learning how to be great instructional designers. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Judy. And to that note, Mike, your platform is intended to sort of support instructors through that and help them create a more active learning environment. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that looks like?
Yeah, for sure. And I would say that fundamentally, I think the challenge that schools have moving forward into this online universe, online or hybrid universe, really has to do with active learning. I mean, that's the critical missing piece that frankly has been missing for not just, since COVID, but for the last, 20, 30 years, as universities have become much more mainstream, far more students going into university. Active learning has always been something that's a bit of a gap for universities. I think for most schools today, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you had very much this kind of sage on the stage, one to many delivery model that frankly didn't work very well to begin with. And it works particularly poorly when you move into the online environment, when you hand the professor, a Zoom account and say, good luck. Now, understandably, as Chip said, schools had very little time to prepare and really create more of an engaging environment for their professors and students. But if that continues, if schools try to continue to move forward with this sort of you know, either a self-paced online type of experience where like there's a bunch of videos and documents on the LMS and students are expected to go through those on their own with minimal interaction with the faculty member and other students, or they, you know, have this Zoom style delivery model. I mean, that's going to be a disaster. You're going to see 20-30% of students opting out. And certainly the surveys that we've done ourselves and our own audience and surveys that otherwise are out there are showing that students will not pay $30,000-$50,000 a year for, you know, lectures via Zoom. What's critical for schools to do if they want to be successful, if they want to now head-to-head compete with really robust, solid online offerings, is to embrace active learning. And the good news is that this is possible. The tools, which maybe arguably didn't exist 10 years ago, today do exist. You can create a truly engaging experience in a digital setting that I actually think can rival the in-person experience. There are many things you can do in a digital setting that you could not do in an in-person environment. And I'm personally excited about that. And that's what TopHat does. I mean, we've been doing this now for 10 years. You can see on my t-shirt. We've been, building, helping faculty members build active learning experiences in their courses, from their content to the in-class or online or remote or in-person environment, to the homework experience, collaboration, and so on. I mean, this is what we do. So it's exciting that this is now coming to light, and I think going to be seen as much more important and essential than it was before.
So let's talk more about how to prepare faculty and professors for this new environment, for this new world. I've been watching my own immediate family, watching my brother and my sister-in-law trying to navigate teaching their classes online with two little kids at home, watching my dad, who just canceled one of his classes, which I didn't know you could do, but he did. And then watching my stepmother try to figure out how to navigate time zones with a largely international student base. So how do we, how do we support professors go through what is a really large transition for them? And I'm going to start with Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, the situation is just a couple months ago here, we had basically every single college instructor be asked to go online and teach online. And about 70% of all faculty have never taught an online class before. And then they're asked to teach an online class with a heads up of 1 to 2 weeks. So I think, Chip, you said it, it's pretty amazing the speed at which institutions have moved to get online. Forget about just an education or technology company. You know, anybody to move that fast to be able to get people online and go 0 to 60 that fast, I think is incredible. And there's this just human psychology of expectations versus reality. And I don't think anybody here 2 months ago was thinking, I'm going to be teaching full-time remotely my students, and I don't think any students were thinking I'm going to be learning full-time remotely during an epidemic. And so in a 2 week period of time, to get to a situation where basically 100% of everybody is learning and teaching online, and it's going to, I think it's impressive what we've been able to accomplish. And two, I think it's incredibly frustrating and it's painful. And I think in those moments, a lot of creativity and problem solving is going to be forced upon people. And I think you're going to get amazing creative problem solving happening. Judy, I think you mentioned that really what technology should do is facilitate access to great teaching. I totally buy into that. And I think, what we're seeing at Coursera, we have about 40,000 US college educators on the platform. And we're seeing about 600% increase in educators coming to the platform to search for materials, download materials, figure out how to compose their classes and teach their classes and assess their students. And I think the opportunity here is, how do we increase access to great teachers, great educators, great resources because ultimately that is the opportunity. Crises, you know, they tend to unveil some realities that have already been happening or below the surface and are accelerating. And one of them is the reality that there is an advantage, a reach advantage and a cost advantage to online solutions. And there are a lot of problems with those solutions to date. And I think if 75% of students, and there's a lot of to unpack there, but 75% of students say that it's not a quality experience, that insight should be driving a lot of research and innovation to improve the experience and ultimately increase access to better instructors and better resources in an affordable 24/7 on demand and affordable way.
Julia, could I possibly jump in here?
Because
I know that we're talking about the online medium that we're confronted with now. But I also wanted to just wave the flag, understandably so, because we are a residential campus, though have a significant presence online. When we survey our students, overwhelmingly they want to come back to campus, and overwhelmingly they are willing to do the kinds of things that would enable them to come back to campus responsibly. Participating testing, regular temperature taking, PPEs, alternating classes, and so forth. So they're part of society's great commitment to getting through this crisis. But we can't ignore some of the things that are a particular advantage of being online, on ground, that online can't possibly do. And that's all of the extracurricular activities that students do develop from, all of the leadership opportunities, clubs, peer-to-peer contact that occurs very spontaneously, activism, exposure to interdisciplinarity, the unfamiliar and uncomfortable, the virtual, the opportunities to engage in discussions that happen just because you cross a quad. So are we confronted with this reality? Absolutely. Does it have advantages? Absolutely. Do we need to change in certain ways on residential campuses? Ask the question of the holiness of an academic calendar. Does it have to be that way? What's a course? Does it have to be that way? What's the credential? Does it have to be that way? But I don't want to leave this panel thinking that there are only advantages associated with online.
Thank you, Judy. And you know, that gets at something in some of our pre-conversations that you and a number of the panelists talked on, which is this moving towards more of this hybrid model. Chip, can you talk a little bit about that, the sort of new hybrid model of offline and online, and thinking about, you know, where you can use online in ways that really harness the power of technology and where you would still leverage offline?
Happy to. By the way, I pulled out my daily team time microphone to rival Mike's branding on his shirt. Nice branding, Mike. By the way, it's good to see some friends on this panel. So, Judy, it's nice to see you again. Mike, it looks like you're hanging in there well. So I would say, you know, we recently updated our vision for the company and really do believe that everything will become blended and connected over time. And what you're seeing overnight right now is basically the hybridization of higher education. I mean, it literally happened immediately and urgently. And we think, you know, I'm an optimist about this. I do think it will drive all kinds of positives. I agree with Judy entirely that the campus, you know, we're big believers in the campus experience, even though we obviously run a program that builds high quality online programs. Everything is blended and connected. And we've done many in-person events. You know, the Yale PA program that we run with Yale University, it's the only fully online PA program. It was really difficult to get off the ground, incredibly intense. It's a true blend. All of the instruction is done online, but then people obviously have to go in and do their clinicals. So when you start going to the undergrad level, there's no question that you'll have to think creatively about compelling virtual experiences that are primarily online during this time period because of the situation we're facing. I would say, if you look at the programs that we're running today that are undergrad, the London School of Economics, we launch in October. And it's been, this has been a fascinating couple of months. I would say just if you look from March to April, what I found fascinating is I do think we are at a moment in time where kind of all bets are off in terms of what we might have thought before this. And what I mean by that is, so not only did that program's demand go up month to month 216%, I mean, it's a crazy number, but what I thought was also really fascinating about it was that 36% of the prospects that came in for the program were of traditional college age. So I actually think it kind of shows real time that people are considering different options that they may not have considered before. So we're thinking a lot about how to drive the highest quality experience for those students who might have been traditionally more of a campus-based student. Now, in this temporary period we're in, we have studios in to produce courses. You know, a single 2-year course has more video content than a season of Game of Thrones. It's a lot of content. And as Mike said, it's sort of active learning. So you're flipping the classroom and you're consuming stuff on your own time and then you go to class. Well, what do you do to produce those courses right now? Our studios are in DC, LA, London, and Cape Town. Well, but they're shut down because of COVID. So we deployed something that I thought was pretty cool called Studio in a Box. Worked out a deal with Logitech to get these high quality cameras, microphones, a background for the professors with good lights. And it allows you to produce right now, when we're physically shut down, higher quality online courses, purpose-built for the online environment. But the key to it is the great instructional design team from 2U that helps the faculty build the right experience. So Judy said it earlier, but you know, this is not just a huge challenge for the university, but it's also the moment for instructional designers. I mean, this is the moment where the pedagogy will matter from the front end in terms of what the output is. I guess I would say, as an optimist, you know, we released a study with Gallup a couple of months ago that I felt like put a final nail in the coffin as to whether or not online can be as good as the campus. Every single measure showed that if you do it well, it will be done. It will create the right outcome for the student. Looking forward, I'm pretty excited about what we see happening right now in online education. It is clearly, I take sort of a personal sense of responsibility right now of how important this moment is for 2U, for our university partners.
One element of pedagogy that's been getting a lot of attention has been around assessments and academic integrity. There was a Recode article that came out that was called "Paranoid About Cheating is Making Online Education Terrible for Everybody." So how do we think about academic integrity post-COVID, or how does this online experience help allow us to sort of rethink academic integrity as a whole? And I want to start with Mike.
So we actually just recently launched a remote proctoring solution. We did it somehow in the span of a week. When we saw this, you know, this huge COVID challenge rearing its head, in front of all of our faculty members, and when we saw this COVID challenge, coming up in front of our faculty members, and they needed to finish out their the rest of their semester, and one of the biggest challenges they had was around, all right, how are we actually going to be able to run our exams? And so we put out this product to allow them to do it in a secure way. And it was fascinating to watch how differently people reacted to it. Some courses, some faculty members in schools went to a pass-fail model open book exams, so, which is fine. I think that was a reasonable solution. And others actually went to the other extreme. We had one faculty member that ran 47 exams in the remainder of the January semester. I don't know how you run 47 exams, but huge adoption of this technology. And we saw, for people that were overusing it, then you required their students to have their camera on and the room scan and the lockdown and all that. Students did react to it negatively. There was very much this sort of big brother kind of perspective. So approaching that technology from a balanced standpoint to make sure that, first of all, it's used when appropriate, sparingly, not 47 times, and ensuring that assessments that don't need to be done in a high stakes way are done in a way that's more flexible, you know, and appropriate for the content. The other thing I'll say, just I wanted to respond a little bit to Chip's comments earlier, because I could not agree more with respect to the essential need today for focusing on pedagogy, instructional design, and enabling professors. And this certainly relates to even this topic around high stakes assessments. You know, one of the things that an instructional designer might say is, hey, you probably shouldn't run 47 high stakes exams in the remainder of the semester. So it's critical to enable faculty to support them in adopting technology that maybe they previously weren't able to do and didn't get the support that they needed to be able to implement active learning in their courses. But I truly believe that with the right amount of support from institutions, from partners like TopHat to you, others, universities can, you know, make this transition, which I think ultimately looks like a hybrid model for probably majority of courses moving forward, even after COVID is done.
Andrew, what are your thoughts in terms of how do we think about academic integrity in this post-COVID world?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to figure out how do you optimize for learning and how do you optimize for asking and answering questions, sharing and learning from each other, whether it's from conversations with your classmates, whether it's office hours, whether it's study halls. One wants to figure out how to do that and make sure that in a world where you're making knowledge available and increasing access, which is the whole point of figuring out how do we learn as much as possible per unit time? How do we acquire the knowledge, consume the knowledge, exercise the knowledge, and then fundamentally prioritizing academic integrity and being able to assess how much have I learned by some point in time becomes a necessary condition. And I think, Mike, that's amazing that you're able to create a solution, proctoring solution, in such a short amount of time. You know, there's a number of different solutions for especially summative assessments where proctoring solutions can be a good outcome, where in that situation, you want to be able to make sure that you're able to assess a student on some sort of question and answer like assessment. You've got anti-plagiarism tools that could be helpful for making sure that you have integrity surrounding more unstructured or writing assessments. I think what we're seeing in our community, we're seeing a huge amount of usage right now from our 40,000 educators searching millions of resources, a huge emphasis actually on searching for assessments. And we're seeing a huge amount of creativity that is spanning from, you know, classic search of different question banks, test banks, et cetera. And we see this opportunity to basically make available a huge pool of questions and answers, such that when you actually get to assessment time, you know, if a student is able to learn and understand and answer, you know, the 10 to 20 questions correctly, when they've been given a pool of 1,000 questions, we see amazing educators such as Professor Neil Garg, who already does that himself, but then by him being able to share resources with other educators, they're able to faster, more effectively also be able to get up to speed and running their own assessment. So we kind of have this sharing capability, this pooling capability to leverage the increase in number of resources, which can be really helpful for assessments. And I think go ahead, Chip.
No, sorry, I didn't mean, I thought I was going to jump in at the end. Keep going.
So I think we see a lot of creativity outside of the classics of more structured assessments around Q&A to more unstructured assessments around writing. And so you have the classic proctoring, the classic anti-plagiarism solutions. That's really important for summative examinations, but they can't get in the way of whatever the solutions are, of making sure that we're helping students learn and build confidence and make sure that they have access to the most resources, which is the whole point of this in the first place. And some of these ideas out there kind of connecting to the real world and what's the real world like is providing access to open book exams, or we're even seeing educators ask students for sample questions for them to ask each other during examinations. So I think it's pretty amazing to see different ways in an online experience that we can rethink how to teach and then assess.
Tim?
Julie, yeah, I was just gonna say, I think this is just far from the biggest problem that we have. I really, so we've done this a long time, and I'll quote Corinne Hyde. She's a USC Rossier School of Education faculty member. She's literally taught in our system for 11 years. Don't panic about academic integrity. If students cheat online, they were probably already cheating on ground. Transitioning a class online doesn't suddenly make students cheat. That said, open-ended responses for online quizzes reduce the possibility of cheating. So, you know, I took one of our programs. I took the MBA at Carolina, at UNC Kenan Flagler Business School. And I will tell you, like, the exams were so, like the accounting exam was designed in a way that was so difficult that even if my wife was a CPA, I don't think she could have cheated for me. In other words, like, I do think it's all about how you're building it up front and designing it from the ground up for the best outcome possible. I'm not suggesting that the technology isn't part of the solution. We have proctoring and they're great. You know, like our proctoring solution we think is valuable, but I just think on the long list of things related to the transition to online, this is far from our biggest challenge.
Tuti, anything you want to weigh in there?
I'll weigh in on a couple of points. Thank you. First of all, my question is, like others, maybe the problem is the exam and as opposed to the cheating. What are we trying to test for? If it's about rote learning, it is going to be more prone to cheating in whatever medium you do. And my hope is that we are looking to achieve deep learning, systems thinking, application of more complex ideas, which is inherently less cheatable. You have to ask for some active proof of learning, novel ideas as part of the, think of a novel concept as part of the test. You can't really Google that very easily. Portfolio assessment of learning, project-based assessment of learning. And so these approaches make cheating much more difficult to commit, but it's also much more effective in gearing a class with clarity to those kinds of learning goals. We're about deep learning here, and we're going to assess deep learning in ways that are much less prone to cheating. So I do think, I agree with Chip, it's not nearly as much of a problem if you're thinking about the right kind of learning in the class. I did want to just speak to the other aspect of the fact that all of learning in the world of the future is going to be some form of hybrid. And I actually agree with that, even though we are a significant residentially based campus. And that is that we are all going to use the tools of the internet, digital tools to enrich the learning experience. And one of the great things about this terrible crisis is that it has brought us all to think much more creatively about the pedagogy of learning and teaching. And that has impact in the online world, but it absolutely has impact in the on-ground world too. So we're going to be always embedding some online tools in what we teach and learn. And one of the really great advantages of that model of hyperflex, hyflex, or whatever you want to call it, is that it can accelerate learning. For a long time, Quinnipiac has had these accelerated degrees, 3+1 programs, 4+1, 3+3, in which you're really treating the time of learning as compressed through online learning. I mean, it makes it so much more efficient. And when we talk about making learning more affordable and more accessible to maybe vulnerable populations, time to certificate or time to degree is a very crucial attribute, because time is money and you want to get students in and out into the marketplace much more quickly. And I think that that's a very powerful way of drawing on the tools of online, even if you are an on-ground or a mixed kind of campus. It makes learning that much more affordable and accessible.
Thank you, Judy. So we are quickly running out of time, and there's so many additional topics that we haven't yet covered. But I do want to end on one question, which is, you know, what is the theme that's been running through the summit around let's not let a good crisis go to waste? What is the biggest positive development that is going to come out of this crisis for students? And you can only choose one, and you have 30 seconds. I'll go to Mike.
I'm tremendously optimistic about this. You know, as much as the transition is going to be painful, and you know, there's going to be some things that are done correctly, some things that are done incorrectly. But I really think the most exciting thing about this is the amount of creativity this is going to unleash, not just among students, faculty members, but also businesses. I mean, just the amount of stuff that we've been able to put out in a very short amount of time. I mean, I wonder if Chip or Andrew or Judy, if you guys could echo that, like we've seen productivity go way up. The biggest challenge we've had is keeping people from burning out, given the urgency and, you know, sense of excitement they've got in you know, in addressing and meeting this this challenge. You know, we've seen professors that are in their 80s who are using Top Hat in their courses transition to online, having never taught online before, with the help of, you know, folks on our team, tools and their own ingenuity and creativity, create incredible experiences for their students. There, you know, a stream of positivity and excitement that's kind of coming out of all of our users. So I'm really excited. I really believe that at the end of this crisis, let's say a year down the road, we're going to come out with a higher education system that's ultimately better. It's more effective, more affordable, and more innovative, and focuses on active learning and pedagogy, which is really what it was all about to begin with. So I'm excited.
Andrew?
Access. I think the opportunity to create affordable 24/7 on-demand availability of amazing instructors and amazing resources is the dream. And I think that has already been an underlying massive trend. And this is going to accelerate that. It already has, with a huge trigger point that's very acute, but that's going to continue. And the economics of that are part of the reason why. And this will help the reality that 40% of all students in US college are working 35 or more hours per week. Over a quarter of all students are parents. They have kids and they're going to school too. There's an overlap between these two. We've got 40% of students who go to college, they don't graduate within 6 years. And a massive, you know, just systemic issues here, that creating flexibility and, you know, Judy, you referenced how we can do that in a blended way, both offline and online. And I think it's a huge opportunity to provide with increased reach, the cost advantages to increase access to great teachers, great resources on demand, and make it affordable.
Judy, the biggest positive development that's going to come out of this for our students?
Well, I'll violate the rules a little bit, and I'll just mention what I've already mentioned before, but then go on to one other. I do think, I mean, those of us who've all been trained to be, you know, the typical faculty member at a university, we focused on the content of what our expert base was supposed to be, and then were thrown into the classroom. And you were born to be that teacher, which of course we're not. We're not born to be teachers. So this notion of the science of teaching, instructional design, which has been so central to this move to online and amplified the need for that, that is going to translate into every form of teaching, online and on ground, which is a tremendous development. And we've all talked about that here. But I will mention one other thing. All of us know that there's a health, a mental health crisis on campuses too. the escalation of the need for counseling services and support for emotional well-being has been something that has escalated to crisis levels. And what we've seen in our personal lives, as well as on campuses, is this shift to telemedicine, teletherapy, telehealth. And I think that we have gotten used to the intimacy of looking at the person at the other side as a friend and as somebody you can confide in and speak to. And I do believe that this will help alleviate the crisis of emotional well-being on campuses in a way that will be game-changing. So telemedicine also for campuses.
Okay. I guess I'm your wrap-up, Julia, huh?
Well, actually, I just got a ping saying we're going to have one more question, but I still want an inspirational close from you, Chip.
Well, I mean, you know, I share Mike's optimism. You know, I'm optimistic about everything except my Flock of Seagulls 80s haircut that's going on, because I can seem to cut the sides and not the top. But, you know, here's what I would say is that right now, you know, it is clear that no one's ever faced anything like this before, and it is scary. But I do believe that there is a lot of good coming out of this. And I would say from a 2U perspective, affordability is very top of mind. And I do think that this will have a long-term impact on affordability at the undergraduate level. We have two undergraduate programs today. They are both differentially priced. And we think that that is something you will see as here to stay. You know, the whole system needs greater affordability. Sustainability is something we're not talking about a ton as a community. And, you know, I feel like we've got a good track record at this point of flexible, high quality, blended programs that are ultimately sustainable for all parties involved. You know, if the student wins, the university wins, then we win. That's how we think about it. But I'm curious, like, what's your wrap up question then?
Hi, well, yes. So we have an encore question, which I'm very excited about. This is one of my favorite topics, which is actually the connection between higher education and employability. Our students are entering one of the worst job markets in history, and there traditionally has been a big disconnect between higher education and that job market. And it goes beyond career services, it goes to what we teach and how we teach and even who we think of as our learner and when they learn. So it's it gets to the core of higher education. I'd love to hear, starting with Judy, your thoughts on what higher education should be doing in preparing our students for the job market, given that your institution is, you know, taking a pretty different approach than most. But starting with Judy.
Thank you. Well, I'm very proud of the fact that Quinnipiac has a really exceptional track record in the transition from school to work, with great outcomes, long-term outcomes in terms of employment. So I absolutely think that higher education's role is to educate for enlightened citizenry, but also to prepare people for careers, evolving careers, and jobs that many of which don't yet exist. So they have to have the flexibility to adjust and be nimble as these jobs materialize and evolve. And we know that many employers don't feel that they're getting what they need, especially around the soft skills. I mean, if it's technical, if it's engineering, perhaps yes, but the soft skills like problem solving, critical thinking, dealing with complexity or uncertainty or ambiguity, innovation and creativity, communication, these are skills that exactly enable you to morph into the next phase of a job because you can step back and see how to ask the questions. That kind of deep learning positions students. And I think it's incumbent on us, and that is an advantage to learning by practicing, learning by doing, to help students get a realistic preview, get very well prepared through experiential learning, through internships, through immersions, through participant learning, through having employers in the presence of students, narrowing the gap between school and work, changing the venue, having students study robotics, study data analytics on site. I mean, using the clinical model of healthcare, of practicing, you'd never put a phlebotomist out there or a radiology technician without having had the real on the ground internship. And that's what we do for learning by practicing. One other thing that I would mention is that we, and I think this happens, this will happen more and more as a result of COVID, that we will not be as obsessed about the singular degree, that we will have certificates or badging along the way towards a degree, which gives students marketability well before they are graduating. That employers are going to influence us and say, this certificate has value. I want to hire somebody who is young, isn't yet graduated, but has these coding skills, has these robotic skills, has these analytic skills. And that, of course, makes college more affordable and more accessible because you can already start earning along the way, exactly as Andrew said. So I think there are various ways in which we can really increase the smooth transition, the seamlessness of school to work, and we are doing that.
And Chip, I want to give the floor to you because I know you have some things you want to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know if you saw the Strata Education poll. I thought it was pretty mind-blowing that 36% of the people polled said that they would change their careers if they lost theirs during COVID. So you're talking about the type of unemployment that we've never seen before. I told my son, who's about to go to college, hopefully, I told him that, you know, I didn't think I would see 2008 again. We started 2U in 2008. And, you know, obviously this is severe. And so creating relevant opportunities for people to have successful job outcomes is critical. Over the years, we've diversified the company into a strategy that we call the career curriculum continuum. So thinking about the university being central to the student's life across a variety of hyper-relevant product opportunities. So whether it be short courses to help somebody stand out from the crowd or a boot camp that would help them actually become a full coder, but doing that with the university in a central role. I do think that relevance is super important. So whether it's technology training or, you know, like our healthcare jobs right now, I feel like, you know, we're at this crux of society at 2U right now, where we are delivering roles that the world desperately needs. We had a Simmons nursing student named Taylor Campbell who went viral on Facebook with like 500,000 likes, who was in the final stages of her clinical placement. And she was talking about, you know, holding the hand of somebody that was dealing with COVID over 21 days. And as her placement ended, this person recovered and was extubated. And she went on Dr. Oz, you know, she went virtual. And what I was so proud of listening to Taylor is like, that is what we do. When we do this well, we are putting somebody in a relevant role to save somebody's life with a high quality experience that was indeed delivered mostly online. I feel like society needs that right now. Meeting society's critical needs is part of what our industry has to tackle.
Chip, I think that was an even better close. So with that, thank you all. Thank you so much for joining. This is an incredible moment in rethinking learning and teaching within higher education. And I'm going to hand it over to Michael. Thank you all.
That's what you call a Zoom dance, if you weren't aware. And a Zoom dance is when we were waiting for our featured speaker, Dick Kramlich, and Dick is on now. I think he might have been in his weekly tennis match in a tiebreaker. So but we're delighted to have him on this Zoom with us. Dick is a legend in the venture capital business, a true pioneer, was a founder of NEA, which is one of the largest venture capital firms in the world and one of the most prestigious. Dick, as a venture capitalist, has invested in 10 startups that achieved billion-dollar market values. One, Apple, was a trillion-dollar market value.
Right.
We we felt privileged in 2015 to honor Dick in the inaugural class of the Global Silicon Valley Hall of Fame with Bill Campbell and Diane Greene and Larry Sensini. And Dick truly is one of my heroes, amazing person, and incredible investor, incredible innovator, and just really delighted to have him on our Zoom this morning. So Dick, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing great. I enjoyed listening to that educational forum that was just going on. It was ended on the right note.
It did, it was perfect.
Yeah.
So I want to back up a little bit.
Yeah.
So how did you get in the venture capital business to begin with?
You know, it's partially inherited. I'm on my father's side, a third generation entrepreneur. And on my mother's side, she was very educational. And I would say she was an architect, actually a data architect in her day. So on both sides, I inherited it. And I felt privileged, Michael, in a way, because my grandfather and that side of the family, they were wheat farmers from Germany and from Bavaria and Austria in that area. And when the Great Northern Railroad was getting underway, the gentleman who started it went over and actually recruited an entire village to come over and put grain and wheat in northern North Dakota. And then that, and then he gave everybody 640 acres. It was a great idea, a way to start. Long and short of it is that when my, after that happened, my grandmother and grandfather moved to Idaho, and she said to him, and I've been used to strong women ever since, she said to him, you know, if you want to live on a farm, that's up to you, but I'm not going to. And so he looked around, didn't know what to do, read about a fellow in Tennessee who had just started a new form. He was an industrial engineer and decided a new form of grocery shopping would be self-service grocery. And it was called Piggly Wiggly. And he went to see him and he started the Piggly Wiggly franchise, which ultimately became Safeway.
Yeah.
And that was in 1910, 1920, in that range. So then my father went to University of Virginia. Long and short of it, he did the same thing all over again, the middle of, in Wisconsin, the middle of the 30s. And he sold the company to Kroger. And then when I was going to Harvard Business School, one day I had intercepted going across the campus by one of the deans, and he said, "I'll bet there are a lot of things here that you don't care for." And I said, "No, that's not really true. I really respect everything about this place. Very good education, very good, intelligent people and all that." He said, no, come on, tell me, really. And I said, "Well, I don't think you have enough emphasis on entrepreneurship here." And this was in 1960. And he said, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "Well, I tried to go to General Dorio's class, which was called manufacturing, but it wasn't anything about manufacturing. It was all about entrepreneurship." And I said I couldn't get into it because I'd come from the outside and I wasn't in the Northeast. I came from the Midwest. And he said, "Well, what else?" I said, "Well, I think you ought to really make life as easy as possible for the students and use, calculators and computers and so on." And we were using slide rules. And so long and short of it is, he said, "Well, if I told you that our second best graduate since World War II has just started a company in Boise, Idaho, if I called him and said, you ought to bring you out there and all that, I'll bet you wouldn't go." And I said, "No, I would go." And so I did. And I wound up going all around to, this is how I got into entrepreneurship. I went to Boise, then I went to Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, to Salt Lake City, and then to Denver, where my grandparents were living, the one who started Safeway. And I got a call from a man named John Lockhart, who knew my parents. And he said that he had been Howard Hughes' first right-hand man, was a lawyer and a CPA. He had become executive VP of Kroger, and obviously knew my parents. And so he said, would you stop by in Cincinnati on your way back? And I said, yes. So I did. And he said, you know, what we're going to do here is transform this company. We're going to take it from a regular grocery chain into being a modern corporation. And we're going to systematize it, computerize it, et cetera. And he said, I would like you to come as my right-hand man. And I looked at what was going on. I said, you know, instead of, you know, interviewing for a training position, this is a real deal.
Right.
And so I wound up being there for 5 years, and my job was manager of financial planning for the company. At that time, they had about 200,000 employees. And I said, you know, this is an amazing situation. I oversaw 4 pools of capital, 1 insurance company, 1 top value stamp company, and then 2 pools of our earnings-based stock rewards to all the employees. And I was able to see how you manage portfolios and all that. And what was that was really when in Boston, the first real traces of venture capital were starting. And so I went there, and I was with this, I left Kroger and went to this place as a partner. And they were all O-line Bostonians, except for yours truly. And they were great people. I learned a great deal. I was the youngest partner, so therefore I did all the legwork out in the suburbs of Boston and learned all about new technology. And that really is what got me in the venture business. I felt privileged to learn what I'd learned because I felt I could actually use all that to help employ people rather than start my own firm in something that would be really good. But I felt I was in a better spot to do that. I was lucky there, and consequently, when Arthur Rock wanted to bring in a younger partner to replace Tommy Davis and himself, and he was going to be full time at this. There was an article in Forbes, and it was about the Money Men. He was the first one in that article. So that's really, I responded. My wife went down to Texas to visit her mother, and I spent the weekend reading. And I wrote this letter to him in longhand. And I found out later from our secretary that over 1,000 people had responded, all with programmed resumes and blah, blah. Mine was handwritten. And what I didn't know was that Arthur sent such things over to have a handwriting expert review. So it was up and to the right. I didn't know that. And so I wound up coming in as a 1/3 partner, and he's a 2/3 partner, and I learned a great deal working with Arthur.
Well, it's good you have good handwriting.
Handwriting.
But what did you learn? What did you learn from Arthur? What was, if you said one thing that you learned from Arthur Rock, what would that kind of nugget be? If you thought about your experience with Arthur Rock, if there was one gem of advice or thing that you learned from him, what would that be?
Invest in the people who run the place.
Yeah. And so then you got NEA started. How did that happen? I mean, what was sort of the idea with that?
Well, Arthur and I were talking about starting a new partnership, and I said, it just really, one partnership was great, and two was one too many. And so he and I officed together for a year, 1977. And that's actually when we financed the startup financing for Apple. And how that evolved is I was talking with Tom Perkins, was a good friend of mine. And I thought the world of Tom. He had asked me, I helped him raise his first fund with money of our limited partners. And he asked me to be a partner of his. And I was thinking about it. I really wanted to do something that hadn't been done in the venture business before. And through my time in Boston, I got to know T. Rowe Price pretty well. And one fellow the fellow I worked with wound up being the president of T. Rowe. And so I stayed in touch with him. And then Chuck Newhall, who's one of my co-founders, had been at T. Rowe. He was in charge of all companies over $50 million and under. And then I'd met Frank Ponsell through his pioneering work in underwriting new technology companies at Alex Brown. And I said to Tom, look, I respect what you're doing. I think I'm pretty far along on this relationship. We're going to start the first venture fund that's going to be offices on both coasts and actually make it into a national activity to begin with. And so that's how NEA got started. We started in something that I think relates to today, and that is a very bad time. So we started and we were trying to raise $15 million. And our first limited partner was T. Rowe Price. And then a very good family in New York, part of the John Deere family. And so we started with $4.5 million out of the 15. And a number of the partners that I'd worked with when I was with Arthur came in. And then Frank and Chuck also knew a number of people. And so we wound up raising $16.4 million. And it was in June of 1978. And that's how we got it going. And I said it was a bad time. We chose some very good people to partner with at starting companies, one of them being Bob Metcalf. And anyway, we wound up building that to $65 million within 3 years. And it was it was a great experience, and that we put in, I began to recruit a few people out here, and Chuck and Frank, and Chuck always took care of operations, and we had a very good woman, Nancy Dorman, who managed the business affairs of the partnership. And so we really built in the discipline and the methodology that would allow us to grow on to where they are today, really. And that's about $25
billion. So yeah, $25 billion from $16 million is pretty good.
Sure.
And, Bob, and just for people that aren't familiar, Bob Metcalf is the kind of the godfather, the Ethernet and founder of 3Com. So how analogous do you think 1978 was, and I appreciate it's very different from the venture capital business, but from just right. The uncertainty, challenges, issues, I mean, a lot of people right now hiding under the bed, others look to play offense. What advice would you say in terms of, you know, I mean, there's obviously a tremendous amount of uncertainties, but what is your perspective on how this compares to then, and how do you think about opportunities today?
I think this is one of the seventh times that in my career that I would say is unadulterated great time to start. And so I think I went back and just was reminiscing about this, and you, as I know, Michael, you ask very good questions. And so I was thinking of 74, 87, 90, 99, and 1,000, and then 07, 08, and then today. I was thinking of those are the episodes that we've gone through. And each one we had to kind of reinvent ourselves to start with. Nothing has been significant as what we're going through now. They were all because of overdoing a particular sector of the technology world and life science world. And I'd say what I just heard on the I think people in the educational world is absolutely one of the ground rules for where we are going now. But I don't think that actually this is something that's going to be suitable really in a methodology for quite a while. I think this is where there is the new normal has not been formed yet, but I think we're in the process of forming it. And one of the gentlemen was talking about affordability and sustainability. Those are good words, and I don't disagree with that. But when you look at what's happening, how the dislodging of happening, the millions of people that have lost their jobs, and the free fall of the economy, and then the oil and gas business and what that's going, so fundamental business, retail business, education, you know, sports, all these things have been dismembered. And so I think we're in a brand new era, and the only real winner is the internet. And that's really all the things that are coming out of this are basically the internet with new communication forms, new value systems, new technologies. I mean, we're adopting some of these things that had come forth before we went into this. But this is a brand new era. And I think this is, as I said, I've gone through these other six areas, and they're all interesting. But this one is the most substantive. I think it's going to be with us for a long time, Michael.
Yeah. You mentioned 2008 as being one of those periods, and you chose 2008. I believe it was the year you moved to China. what was sort of the motivation then, and what did you learn?
Well, I've always been an explorer and adventurer.
Yeah, you know. That is for sure.
Yeah, and I'd been going to China for about, since the mid-80s, and because it was too big to be not investigated. And about that time, I thought that Deng Xiaoping was, his modus operandi was beginning to really be important there. And it was. It had a good 20-year run in which they really made something out of China. I question where they are today. I think they've gone back to a controlled economy. And but in any event, at that time, I thought it was, we were in a financial mess in this country at the time. And we had tried to blend credit by, you know, blending mortgage characteristics and things like that. And it was obvious to me we were going to go into a disaster zone. And at the same time, the Olympics were going to be going on over there in 08. So I thought, you know, people say, well, why are you here and not there? I said, would you rather be in a depression or where there are the Olympics going on? Anyway, that wasn't really why, but I did. And but I did want to understand what the Chinese people are like rather than the leadership, because in China, less than 6% of the people belong to the Communist Party. And yet Deng Xiaoping was a capitalist. And I think his philosophy really helped to get China organized. And what they'll do from here forward is another question. But I do think they had a great run in which they really got themselves coordinated. And I think the Chinese mercantile spirit, their entrepreneurial spirit among many of the people, was able to come to the fore. And so that was why I went. And I learned a lot. And what we did was a little different than others. We decided to try to partner with Chinese rather than, you know, dominate the situation. And the consequence has worked out very well. So we have not generated a lot of headlines, and but we have had ownership position, a lot of successful deals.
So you mentioned Harvard Business School before, and one of your classmates there, maybe even a roommate, was Deborah's dad, David Hicks. Was he laid back and passive like Deborah?
That's a good question. You always ask those kind of questions. Yeah. David was probably the best tennis player at Harvard Business School. And he came from a family of great tennis players. And he and I were what they call headmates in our first year. And I was thrilled to see him when Deborah brought him out and her mother brought him out before he passed away. He's one of the best guys around. He was an entrepreneur and a banker, and came from that side of it, and his career was storied in Jacksonville, Florida, and I have an enormous respect for him.
Wow.
And his wife, by the way.
Very kind.
Yeah. This happened to be true.
Well, my only issue here is we were running out of time fast, and I just hope I can get you to do this again, but before we go, I'd love just to get your current thoughts about what are you looking to do in terms of investing. You talked about, you know, this is time of unprecedented opportunities and to get going and so forth with all the challenges. Yeah. What areas are you most excited about investing in right now? And you got Green Bay Ventures that is running and gunning. What are you excited about?
Well, I think, as I mentioned, artificial intelligence applied to analytics, And I think we have a, fortunately have a company we're very proud of called Databricks. We've put in over $70 million into that. And that is clearly has a shot at being a great company. They're already very important. I do think that this is a good time for people who have experience in the life science area. I think it's a great time for that. I think we're waking up to all of this, this disaster that we're going through right now opens up a lot of opportunities in that area. I would say that personally what I'm doing is I'm still the chairman emeritus at NEA. I have a couple of companies that I'm bringing along for their benefit, and they are looking very good, by the way. They're all, one's in the energy area and the fusion area, another one's in the analytics and super software and privacy and cryptology. And I think those are, we have around 20 companies that are in Green Bay that are important. They're going from small to growth to dual investing capability with our LPs. We have family LPs, not institutional. NEA is our only institutional LP. And I have all younger partners. I think that just in looking at the wolf and the waves of what I mentioned in the last, really since the 1960s, so that's 60 years of technology development. I think we're in a great time for essentially establishing new norms. And I think that's where we are, Michael.
Listen, you are a very special, a real treasure to the investment world and to all the different interests that you have. And I wish we had more time to spend on this call, but we can't tell you how much appreciate it. Thank you. You're one of my heroes, and it's always great to see you, and it's always great to get your wisdom. So thank you.
Plus, let me just end on this note, Michael, because I think what you've done is beneficial to the entrepreneurial spirit. You know, by GSV that you have all behind you over here, what you've done is honored people and called attention to people who are making a difference in the world. And that's the benefit. You know the word entrepreneur, you know where it comes from? It's called workmaker. Yeah. It comes from a central part of Europe that was either in France or Germany, depending upon the era. And it was, so that's where that word comes from. And it's to me, that's what you're doing, is you're enhancing the abilities of people to build something that makes a difference.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, thank you so much, Gary.
You're
amazing. Thank you. And thanks everybody for joining us today. Very much appreciate it. We'll let you know. I think next week we're going to have another session. So please zoom in and stay safe and stay optimistic. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Michael. La, 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 da, 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 da. I hope that I should live to see.
thing and we paid our dues. Let's get rid of these freedom blues. It may seem very hard to do. Just open your mind, let love come through. I got my duty rock and roll. Now everybody's gonna be free. Oh. And he ducked back in the alley, oh baby.